Lionel Asbo's State of England is Martin Amis's latest novel. It's about a crass and thuggish man named Lionel Asbo who wins the lottery and is transformed into a crass and thuggish multimillionaire, glorified and vilified in the British tabloids. Its take on modern English society with its celebrity culture and callow cruelty has been called Dickensian by some critics. The book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased to welcome Martin Amis back to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
Should I assume that you don't miss your home country if this book summarizes the way you see the state of England?
No, that would be wrong. I do miss it, and this isn't my furious sort of V sign to England as I leave it short. No, I'm English. I spent half a century living in London. Of course, I'm deeply attached to it.
Well, you've moved your family to Cobble Hill in Brooklyn last year. The phenomenon of people becoming celebrities through no merit of their own is, of course, just as common in this country. Do you find that America's fascination with celebrities and our tabloid culture is all that different from England?
It's the tabloid culture isn't as deep as it is in England. We have four newspapers a day, compared to which, you know, the New York Post, it looks like the Partisan Review compared to the tabloids in England.
Well, so far nobody's accused any of our newspapers of hacking celebrities' phones.
Yes, but as a journalist said, you know, the sort of stories that these tabloids run, even if they were delivered by the stalk, would be deplorable. It's not just the methods, it's what they imagine people want is sort of insulting.
Is this book a bit of revenge because the tabloids went after you for reasons that seemed so petty at the time? The fact that you'd had your teeth done, that you'd had a fallout with Julian Barnes, the writer who had been your friend. It's the sort of thing that seems so minor.
Well, that isn't tabloid culture quite. The only writer who gets into the tabloids is Salman Rushdie. We're not famous enough to be in the tabloids, but there's a sort of middle level of newspaper. The Mail, the Express, and indeed the so-called serious newspapers, too, like to dabble in that kind of thing.
Now, the book is set in Diston, a fictional borough of London, a place where the life expectancy rate is somewhere between Benin's and Djibouti's. Is it modeled after a real place?
No, it's made up. People tend to think that one is writing a sort of documentary analysis of England. It isn't that like that. I did, in fact, have Dickens in mind, and Dickens was not really a social realist. He was he dealt in a sort of fantastic, almost burlesque world. I mean, the closest there is to Dickens in the 20th century is the Disney cartoon, and I realized that my book had many things in common with the sort of fairy tale and the nursery rhyme.
Or exaggeration.
And, of course, exaggeration.
Why does Lionel Asbo, who works on, quote, the very hairiest end of debt collection, change his last name to Asbo?
Because he doesn't like his born name, Pepperdine. He thinks that's a crap name, he says. And Asbo has a nice ring to it. It stands for Antisocial Behavior Order.
That's a creation of the Blair administration.
Yes.
A way of saying juvenile delinquent?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And he got his first Asbo when he was 3 years old.
Well, he started young, and at least he remained consistent. He certainly has street smarts. In one scene, he delivers a disquisition on the legal distinction between ABH and GBH. Can you explain?
Yes. Aggravated bodily harm and grievous bodily harm. And basically it's decided by the extent of the injury. If you're hospitalized, then it's GBH. And if it's merely the first aid kit, then it's ABH.
You've said in the past that you have great affection for your characters, and you've said more recently you love thugs. As subjects of your fiction? Or, I mean, do you really have a fondness for Lionel?
All my life I've had a sort of vein of my daily experience where people like Lionel, I have been encountered. And what strikes me when I meet these people and talk to them is how incredibly expressive and vivid and articulate they are. And you mentioned the Blair administration. It's a deep feeling of mine that his slogan, education, 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 is actually the way forward. And I couldn't agree more passionately about that. And I think there's a lot of untapped intelligence down there.
Well, education has been a murky area in England because the public schools are really private schools, and then the government schools have often been considered less than adequate. And then at a certain age, is there still a test that kids take at the age of 11 that determines their future in many cases?
I'm not sure, actually. I think it's patchy. But it's certainly true that it's a two-tier education system. I was a grammar school boy, and that stratum has been removed. So now it's a question of where you live and how much money you have.
Well, with that in mind, how many people like Lionel, you say that you've had contact with people like that. You're an Oxford graduate and the son of a famous writer. You've probably never lived in a place like Diston. How much contact could you have had with people like Lionel?
It's who you meet, who you talk to. And actually in childhood, my parents' lives took off when my father's first novel, Lucky Jim, was published. And the children were parked for months on end with the family of our cleaning lady. So right from the start, there's always been this level of my life. And I've always enjoyed it and responded to it. And I cultivate it.
Now, you have said that you're not a satirist, that you see yourself more as an ironist. Would you say the same of your father? I was sort of Lucky Jim as very much a brilliant piece of satire.
I wouldn't say satire. I'm not even sure what satire is. It's been defined as militant irony, that is to say, irony with an object, irony that wants to bring about change. And I'm fairly resigned to the fact that novels don't bring about change. They may change this or that reader for the better. And again, it's an educative process.
But well, in America, the Muckrakers actually did have a real impact in the beginning of the 20th century. But, yeah, I think that probably was short-lived.
Yeah, I mean, there are one or two fluke novels, like George Eliot's Daniel Deronda, that had an enormous effect. But it's always a confluence of historical circumstance, not just the novel itself.
One critic called this book A Gleefully Twisted Great Expectations. Would you say that the other main character, Lionel's half-Trinidadian nephew, Desmond Pepperdine, is Pip to Lionel's Magwitch?
The thing about Dickens, although it's not true of David Copperfield, is that all his energy goes into the frumps, the wags, the eccentrics, the villains. And his good characters are very pale and often unbearable, Little Nell and Esther Summerson. The truth is that it's very difficult to make goodness live on the page. And I think only Tolstoy has really made it swing on the page. So I was very aware and excited by the challenge of creating the best character in all my corpus is Desmond Pepperdine, and to make him vivid was a great challenge, much, much more difficult than making Lionel vivid.
Well, he's your first non-white major character. Does he represent a different face of England?
Well, he's an idealized face of England in that he's someone who very much responds to knowledge and wants to accumulate it, whereas Lionel, like many people of his class, feel threatened by knowledge, and also their own intelligence, which is considerable, has never been brought out. So it's a sort of thwarted intelligence.
When he's 15 years old, Desmond writes to an advice columnist about a very big secret, which he lives in fear of his uncle discovering. Since it's on page one, I don't feel like this is a spoiler alert. That does give Desmond a bit of it takes a bit of his virtue away, doesn't it?
It does. But I had to then construct a life shape for Desmond, which would make that initial sin forgivable. So the death of his mother when he's 12, the fact that he is orphaned and has never met his father, and the fact that he's being raised by a kind of anti-father in the shape of Lionel Asbo.
Who urges him to watch internet porn, frowns on his reading books.
And tells him to carry a knife and all the rest of it. So I think you forgive Desmond that.
For having an affair with his grandmother.
Yeah.
Who happens to be Lionel's mother.
Yes. And as he says, with a distant demographic, that sort of thing is not much frowned upon.
Desmond ends up becoming educated, marrying a nice girl, despite his past indiscretions. And he, despite your feelings about the tabloid press, he winds up becoming a journalist.
He's a crime journalist, yes, because of his he's very well placed to write about crime because he really does understand the criminal mind.
But much of this novel is also about what happens to Lionel when he becomes filthy rich. He wins £140 million while he's in jail, and he's followed everywhere by the tabloid press, who can't get enough of his embarrassing episodes and whom he tries to manipulate. The press calls him the Lotto Lout, and I understand there really was a man who was called the Lotto Lout in Britain.
There's a whole mob of Lotto Louts in Britain because it's those sort of people who do the lottery. But I did read the autobiography of one such, a charming book called Careful What You Wish For by Mikey Carroll. And I thought it would be full of marvelous material for me. But as I closed the book fondly, I realized that I had to go in a completely different direction.
Were you concerned at all that you might be taken as an elitist or a snob in writing about this character?
I was accused of doing that in England, which surprised me because I've been doing it for 40 years.
Well, you did with John Self in the book Money, which everybody loved.
I know, and did it in the Rachel papers as well. I mean, I've been doing it for 40 years without challenge. I think it's a great insult to the working class to say that no one from any other class can write about them. I've written a book in which one of the main characters is the King of England, Henry the Ninth. Am I to be forbidden from visiting that class also?
You've written about the inequality in this country as well as in Britain. Do you see the country? We share a language. We share a cultural history. Do you see the countries as being all that different?
Yes. And I think it's historical development. Their historical developments are different. England is just further on down the road. And America is unique. And I believe more in American exceptionalism now I'm here.
One of the funnier things is the line, "Who let the dogs in?" Is used throughout the book, based on a famous Bohemian song, "Who Let the Dogs Out."
Indeed. It sort of hovers over the book. That was one of the first things that came to me when, in the mysterious process of assembling a novel, that was the germ.
Now, you've dedicated the book to Christopher Hitchens. You'd been great friends. Did you show him it before he died?
I did, but in a disgracefully crude version. But he was kind enough to say it was all right. It wasn't all right. I had to rewrite it before it was.
So how many drafts does a book of this sort go through?
Three. Longhand, first type, and then rewrite.
Martin Amis will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 at Book Court in Brooklyn. That's in Cobble Hill. And then this Thursday at 7, he'll be at the Strand talking with Lucas Whitman. And on October 3rd, he'll be at 192 Books. Details for all of those are on our show page at WNYC.org. The novel, Lionel Asbo, State of England, not the State of England, State of England, is published by Alfred Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Always a pleasure.